From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A group of physicians calls for some face-to-face public school instruction in one Michigan community.
Older kids are dealing with much higher rates of anxiety and depression. Younger kids are really starting to act out more.
Today, the case for a return to the classroom. Also, Interlochen Arts Academy adapts a beloved holiday tradition for the pandemic Christmas on a fast-forward rehearsal schedule.
It's actually turned out to be quite astonishing how these dancers all came together without having any sort of physical contact with each other and still being able to tell the story.
We'll tell you when and how to see it. And pro tips for you from Christmas tree producers in Michigan.
Sometimes I go out and I'll think, oh, you know, I want a Fraser fir. And then I get out there and I'm like, no, I want that Concolor fir. It smells like oranges and it's so pretty.
That's all coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, a lot of people are searching for a little slice of normal this year. And for many, a fresh Christmas tree is just the thing.
People wanting to get out and get back to some normalcy, some level of common shared family experience that maybe they haven't been able to have here in 2020.
That's coming up on the show. But first, Michigan's public schools will keep middle and high schoolers on distance learning at least through winter break, according to the latest orders from the State Department of Health and Human Services. There are some districts that have maintained face-to-face teaching, at least for younger grades, with precautions this year. But a number of our larger districts, including Detroit, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor, have gone all virtual. A group of physicians in Ann Arbor is urging its local school board to open up in-person instruction for elementary and special education students. Dr. Omar Karthikeyan is one of 100 MDs who signed a letter asking for consideration for this, that some kids could go back to brick-and-mortar classrooms in January. Dr. Karthikeyan, welcome to Stateside.
Good to be with you, April.
Now, the letter points out a number of clinical issues that you're asking the Board of Education to consider, and I do want to talk about those. But first, can I just ask you about what you're hearing from your patients and their folks? How is staying at home affecting children's health right now?
Yeah, this has been a real issue that we've seen over the last basically 9 months. This started back in the spring when schools first closed, and we've been seeing a lot of tremendous emotional challenges that kids have been dealing with, really across the age spectrum. Older kids are dealing with much higher rates of anxiety and depression. Younger kids are really starting to act out more and manifest some of these symptoms of anxiety that kind of typically present as just sort of defiance and fighting with parents. And really across the board, everybody is having a hard time engaging and learning and getting a whole lot of sort of meaningful interaction out of the school experience.
Are your bigger concerns at this point emotional or physical or strictly within the realm of mental health?
I think it would be hard to pick one of those things. There's certainly the mental health piece of it is important, and that affects the family dynamic. And likewise, we also know that these lockdowns have led to rising rates of child abuse. So school is a refuge for a lot of these kids. It gives them an opportunity to connect with other people who might be their outlet from some of these more abusive situations. So the physical part of it is very real as well. And as these kids struggle to both engage and achieve academically, that affects their self-esteem, which has a lot of impact on their physical health. Also, the rising rates of obesity and just in general, kids are becoming more sedentary.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact that schools are often the mandatory reporters who may be the first to bring abuse to county officials' attention. I imagine some of that has fallen to doctors and nurses in the meantime. So what is the case for expanding in face-to-face learning to include elementary students in the mind of you and your colleagues?
Yeah, I think our goal is to dispel this notion that we have to choose between health and safety and education. We can do both. And at the outset of the pandemic, it made sense to close schools because we assumed that the coronavirus was going to behave the way influenza does, which spreads rapidly through schools. But it became fairly clear in the early summer that that was not really what was happening in children. They don't seem to be affected as much. And then as we've made it through the summer and now kind of 2 to 3 weeks into school in a lot of places, we realized that with some very basic precautions, we can implement school safely and do it in a way that serves children while protecting staff, protecting teachers and students, and giving them what we know they need.
So my first question on reading this was thinking about the small but really tragic number of cases where we have seen some children in Michigan get ill from the coronavirus, sometimes be hospitalized because of the coronavirus. There have even been a couple of deaths. I know that doctors are not insensitive to this. In fact, the opposite. But how do you evaluate the risk?
Yeah, and absolutely, I think that's a key point. We're not saying that children are not at risk and that they cannot get sick or seriously ill. What we're saying is that in general, their likelihood of both contracting and spreading the virus is dramatically lower than it is in adults, and their risk of severe illness is even more dramatically lower. So Washtenaw County, for example, kind of where we live here in Ann Arbor, the number of cases as they break it down for children, so 0 through 17, that number has always been around 5%, give or take, of cases. So it represents a very small number of the overall number of cases. Currently, it's 0% of hospitalizations and 0% of deaths. And there's a lot of data from all over the world, particularly in places where they have had in-person school overseas, and they've shown that there's very little risk of transition within the classroom setting. And there's not a lot of transmission from children to teachers when basic precautions like masking, social distancing, good hand hygiene, and cleaning, disinfecting services are put in place and adhered to.
My second question is what physicians who attend school teachers and school staff and parents would say about this. Is it fair to ask them to assume the risk if younger kids go back to school?
Well, look, I think obviously we care deeply about teachers and keeping them safe. And again, I don't think that this has to be a choice between allowing them to do what they have done so well for their entire careers and doing it safely. There are very basic things that we can do to allow them to feel like they can do their jobs and carry out their craft in a safe way. And a lot of different organizations and industries have figured out ways to do that. And we can do that as well. And I also think that there's an expectation that in the community, we're going to do our part to keep you safe as well. So that means being mindful of the decisions that we make outside of the classroom and making sure that we are emphasizing to our children the importance of complying with wearing their masks and maintaining that social distance so that they're not putting other people at risk. I think early on in the pandemic, there was some question of whether young children would be able to comply with some of those basic things, but we found that they have no problem doing that when the community and the parents emphasize those behaviors at home and we model it in our daily lives.
We know that children don't seem to contract full-blown COVID at the rate at which adults do, but do you feel like we know enough about children as carriers?
I think we're learning more. I don't know that one could ever say we know enough about anything this virus does because we didn't know anything about it just 10, 11 months ago. But I do think that we have learned enough about it to feel comfortable about this decision. And again, I think viewing this as a simple choice between, you know, two co-equal options of education where the only X factor here is whether or not people are going to get more sick is the wrong way to think about this. I think that we know enough to know that based on the places that have been going to school and have done it with appropriate safety measures in place, that can be done safely. We know that if we have several layers of safety built in, we can prevent children from getting exposed and getting sick. And we can do the same for teachers as well.
I noticed that your letter does not suggest sending middle schoolers and high school students back into the classroom just yet. Can you say a little bit more about that?
It's a slightly more nuanced issue, and I don't want to make it seem as if we're against doing that as well, but we recognize that the risk of transmission among older kids is certainly very different when you get into particularly over 10. And so in the high school range, they sort of behave much more like college students in terms of their ability to contract and spread the virus. And so clearly there is a lot of apprehension about this. So we want to say, okay, let's get kids, the younger kids in the classroom who we know we can get there safely. And then let's show the folks who are apprehensive about doing this that, look, there's a way this can be done. And then as we move forward, we can kind of work on middle school and high school students as well. But, you know, we also feel that with basic precautions, middle school and high school can be done safely also. So we're certainly not opposed to that. But I think if we're going from no school at all for anybody, I think baby steps are pretty reasonable.
A lot of leaders have talked about taking a science-based approach right now in their decisions. Can I ask, what does that mean to you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, again, what I would finish with is that if your objective is to remain 100% virtual, there are plenty of things that you could point to support that position, but none of them are based on any data that support that position. And in contrast, there is, in fact, a growing body of evidence that is emerging as schools have gone back in person at some level over the last few months, that a safe return to elementary school is frankly not that difficult at all, and that we are doing great harm to children by this steadfast commitment to 100% remote learning. So if we're failing to educate them, we're failing to support their socio-emotional needs, then, you know, what exactly are we doing?
Dr. Omkar Karthikeyan is a pediatrician in practice in Ann Arbor, and he's, as we've said, one of about 100 doctors who are asking for consideration for some face-to-face learning this year. Dr. Karthikeyan, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, April. I appreciate the time.
For many families, going to see a local production of The Nutcracker is a holiday tradition. This year, a production you'll be able to see online came up with creative ways to keep the sugar plum fairies dancing.
I felt, well, if they're dancing, that's less time to be sort of interacting and standing around and getting close to one another.
In a second, we'll meet the choreographer and one of the principals. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Have you ever gone to see The Nutcracker in December? For some families, this might be the only live dance performance that they see in the course of a year. And for many, it's a beloved holiday tradition. Interlaken Center for the Arts will stream a new, fully staged production of Tchaikovsky's holiday classic on Saturday, December 12th. It incorporates the safety measures of the day and some innovations. Detroit Public Television will broadcast Interlaken's production at 8 p.m. on Christmas Day if you're one of the many, many people who cannot go see a live performance right now. Students went to great lengths to make this production happen. As you know, public high schools are in virtual instruction for at least 3 weeks. Here to tell us about how they've done it is Joseph Morrissey, Interlaken's director of dance, and Ava Blaine, a student who's dancing the role of Clara. She is from Traverse City. Ava, Joseph, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Happy to be here.
For folks who may not be familiar with the story, The Nutcracker is all about a little girl who dreams a treasured nutcracker prince, a gift from her godfather, comes to life, battling a mouse king and whisking her away to the land of sweets. I mean, this is the stuff of classic fairy tales. I want to talk a bit about how the COVID production has been different, but before we go there, Joseph, could you pull back the curtain a bit on how you decided to interpret the story for the production this year?
Yes, well, it was important to keep the essence of, as you said, April, this sort of fairy tale magic and to capture it in a way that was going with the restrictions that we have, that was adhering to all of the policies that we as an institution are moving forward with. But at the same time, we wanted to make sure that we were keeping a certain pace, that people were getting that holiday familiar tale that they come to love every, holiday December season. So it is in many ways paced in a way that is still the same as if we were not in this COVID situation, albeit with some choreographic differences. And I have to say it's been created not so much as a quote unquote COVID version, but just a new version of the Nutcracker for everyone to enjoy.
Right. What does it take to put on this performance in regular times? Ava, have you ever been involved in a Nutcracker production before this? It's kind of a chestnut that a lot of dance students take some part in over the years.
I was in a Nutcracker when I was younger, but my first big Nutcracker I've been a part of was last year at Interlaken.
Yeah. And what's a normal production like?
Last year was my first year, but a normal production includes a full orchestra, which was a really amazing experience I had last year, getting to perform with live music. And our performance have many elaborate sets that really make our Nutcracker come to life, and lots of beautiful costumes.
Yeah. Joseph, I know that the Nutcracker is not only something that, audiences look forward to. I mean, this is something that a lot of companies produce every year just to, give folks a nice experience for the holidays and make sure they can, ensure some ticket sales. How would you describe what it takes to pull off a full production of the Nutcracker under normal circumstances?
Well, under normal circumstances, as Ava mentioned, at Interlaken, we are so fortunate to have a partnership with our music division. So we do normally have the luxury and privilege and honor of working with a live orchestra, which is so rare, for a high school to have that cooperation. Of course, this year, given the restrictions, that was not possible. So we resorted to a recording. And I think it's something what I've been telling to the students and to really everyone here is that this really just needs to be the year of and the Nutcracker of what we do have, versus what we don't have. And so in an ordinary situation, first of all, we would have a bit more time. This was an unusual situation already because I added a fall performance. So we were kind of strapped for time as it was. And then to receive the order and put this on 4 weeks before its premiere or its opening date, that definitely was probably the biggest difference between what would, quote, be an ordinary and what would be an unordinary year.
Yeah, my understanding is the students performed and filmed this nearly 3 weeks ahead of schedule so that just in case the emergency order gets extended, the video could be streamed as scheduled. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. I didn't want to take chances, just given how things are going, that if this order gets extended, that we would not have a Nutcracker this year. And so on Sunday night, when the order was issued, I called our production offices and I just said, guess what? Guess what we're doing on Tuesday? We are going to film. And I think the students on Monday, when I told them, oh, by the way, we are going to film the Nutcracker tomorrow, there was, of course, a bit of shock, but then there was also a sense of relief because all that hard work and all that knowing that people would be able to get to see this magical performance, that would still be possible.
Ava, do you remember your reaction when he laid this news on everyone?
Yeah, I was a little nervous because we wouldn't have the extra time to prepare and get ready for the Nutcracker like we usually do. But I was also really excited that I'd be performing as Clara the next day. And and I feel really grateful, like Mr. Morris, he said, that we have our production to show for this because we had all been working on it for a long time. And it's always really amazing to be able to be part of the Nutcracker and share that. So I'm glad we can still do that this year.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Ava Blaine, a dance student at Interlochen who's performing the role of Clara in The Nutcracker this year. And we're also speaking with Joseph Morrissey. He's Interlochen's director of dance. Clara has a huge role in this production. You spend a lot of time on stage. I mean, there are periods when even if you're not dancing, like you have to sort of be there and be present with the action that is happening. And so little time to prepare. I mean, how did you manage learning and doing everything you had to do in that time frame?
I guess I just tried to make the most of our rehearsal time that we did have. And I practice a lot at my house, actually. I just go home and I love to go over all of my steps and the choreography. And I feel like even though we didn't have as much time as we expected, the Nutcracker still looks amazing. And for me, I feel like we had enough rehearsals so that it still looks just like it would on a normal year. It's not anything less. It still looks beautiful.
I have to say, we had access to some of the rehearsal footage in full dress, and it looked great. Joseph, can you explain how you did things differently this year to keep the dancers safe in this time of COVID?
Sure. Well, naturally, the first thing was just keeping distancing in mind when producing the choreography, which in many ways has turned the coin and given opportunities for more dancing for everyone. I mean, a lot of parts that normally would have been sort of maybe like as you mentioned, standing around or walking around, there's this big party scene, have actually turned more into choreographic sequences, because I felt, well, if they're dancing, that's less time to be sort of interacting and standing around and getting close to one another. So there was that. And, you know, of course, we had to be cautious. There's no what we call pas de deux or partnering when, you know, there are actually physically touching each other, whether it's a lift or whatnot. There is one dance that would have some semblance of partnering in the coffee dance. But we've used sort of this long silk scarf to kind of keep somewhat of an essence of it. But I have to say, a lot of people were saying to me, how are you going to be able to do this? How is it possible? And it's actually turned out to be quite astonishing how these dancers all came together without having any sort of physical contact with each other and still being able to tell the story through the choreography and the pantomime. And we also made sure that anything that was a prop or any sort of 3D object, that whoever handled it was the same person in and out. So, you know, there's a big box where the Nutcracker comes out of, and there's any sort of props that we made sure that they were handheld by the same people.
Having this experience of putting on one of the biggest shows of the year in a rush, in the middle of a pandemic. Joseph, what do you think this offers all the students? I mean, this would be a learning experience under any circumstances, but what do you think this is going to give them in terms of their professional skill set?
Yeah, well, a sense of readiness, preparedness, resilience, perseverance, probably more words than you were looking for. But I mean, so much. I said to them, this is a once in a, you know, hopefully for this reason of a pandemic, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. And, you know, we can, you know, we can choose to either rise to the occasion or not. And we did, and the students did. And I think it's really a sense of readiness. I told them, some of them, that, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, when, you know, the famed Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo was traveling around the country, this is what they did. They would get on a bus one night and perform in Oklahoma, and the next night they were off to Texas or, you know, wherever they may be. And this was really how it was. But I think it's important for me as their leader to instill this sense of readiness day to day. I mean, in the back of my head, I sort of had in mind, this could happen. So we always have to be ready for the unexpected and to let our art form be a fuel for that.
Jeez, it's a lot.
Yeah.
Ava, can I ask you a little bit more about your role?
Yeah.
For this production, Clara has been re-envisioned as a young adult, and her relationship with the life-size Nutcracker doll turned handsome prince needs to have a little bit more of a romantic tone. And at the same time, you have these restrictions on, you know, how you and your partner are going to dance. How did your performance change, do you think, as a result of that?
I think typically, like this year, the romantic element between Clara and the Nutcracker is new. But typically, like, that would be conveyed through partnering. And since we can't touch right now, I think both my partner and I have found ways to convey like romantic feelings without being too close. I think for me that was a little hard, like artistically trying to do that. Mm-hmm. But just like our dancing, our choreography helps a lot, and yeah.
Well, yeah. I would just say too, April, that when you have a score like Tchaikovsky, you know, whether it's the Nutcracker or Swan Lake or Sleeping Beauty, you know, his big three ballets, if you let the music guide you, you won't have any problem at all. I mean, everyone, like I said, how are you going to do this? Well, if I have Tchaikovsky's music, I can do anything. Because if you let the music guide you and you don't really you don't necessarily need to do this or that, as long as you're showing it through the dancing and the emotions. Just a simple gesture of an arm movement can mean so much if it's done well. And Ava and her Nutcracker partner, George, did a phenomenal job and really demonstrated a sense of maturity. And like you said, April, in such a quick amount of time. But I do credit, for me at least, in producing all of this, the music. I mean, if you have that beautiful music, you really should be able to do something that still is just as powerful as if we were in a normal situation.
Have the residential students, have they been sent home or are they still on site?
Some of them are still on site, and some of them, when this order was issued, did decide to return home. We all wanted to do this Nutcracker. So everyone stayed to get through that filming on Tuesday the 17th. In fact, it was one of the students' birthdays, and I said, well, what a better birthday present than this. But then after that, because we at one point had thought, oh, maybe we'll still do another live performance of this. But again, I didn't want to take those chances. And so I think day by day, some students have started to return home. And then some are braving out the storm and are going to be with us throughout the remainder of this semester. It will make for one of the most memorable performances, I think, certainly of the Nutcracker in history. I think this is, in a way, it sounds so grand to say, but I mean, it is, in a way, this performance of the Nutcracker is a historic event, and something that I'll certainly remember. And I think all of the students will remember this experience, this day of filming, the rushness, all the stories that went along with it. It's going to make for quite a remarkable performance and memorable experience indeed.
Joseph Morrissey, Interlochen's director of dance. We've also been talking with Ava Blaine, a student who's dancing the role of Clara. And again, Detroit Public Television will be broadcasting Interlochen's production at 8 p.m. on Christmas Day for most of Michigan to see. Joseph, Ava, it's really nice talking to you. Thank you for sharing this story with us.
Thank you, April. Pleasure's been ours. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Up next, paper or plastic? Not actually asking about your shopping bags, but rather your Christmas tree. The industry adds $35 million to Michigan's economy, and this year's sales are up. So what Christmas tree styles are trending in 2020?
You know, it's not the Clark Griswold opening up the tree in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation anymore. They want that smaller, slender tree. It's easier for them to handle.
That's next after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Maybe it's us, but it certainly seems like Christmas decorations went up a little early this year. Is it our need for something uplifting and festive? Anything uplifting and festive right now? If so, Michigan, as one of the top holiday fir tree producers in the country, is the right place to be. With us today are Amy Start, Executive Director of the Michigan Christmas Tree Association, and Scott Powell, who is Nursery Manager at Dutchman Tree Farms in Manton. That's just north of Cadillac. Amy, Scott, welcome to Stateside.
Welcome. Hello.
Thanks for having us.
First of all, could you two tell us how the season's going so far? Scott, I know you have a pretty large operation. How are sales going this year?
Sales really across the country has been very positive. We've seen a lot of retail garden centers, retail corner lots, as well as box stores looking to reorder and replenish. A lot of folks saw over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, really almost two weekends worth of sales. Maybe that's a testimony to a reduced Black Friday push on the retail side, or maybe it's just a cause of people wanting to get out and get back to some normalcy, some level of common shared family experience that maybe they haven't been able to have here in 2020. But retail sales have been strong on the wholesale side. I know a lot of choose and cut farms are experiencing the exact same thing. Some farms even being up almost 100% year to date.
Well, it's confession time. We actually did put up more than one tree in our house this year just to try to get the spirit rolling a little faster. Amy, does that track with what you're hearing from other producers?
Oh, yeah. It's been a very, very busy season for sure. You know, people are excited. Matter of fact, a lot of farms, you know, it's been so busy that, you know, I suggest people call ahead and make sure they're still open because they have been so busy selling out. So it's been a great, great season.
Are there ways in which the pandemic has affected the season for growers? I'm not necessarily talking about demand and how many people might want an extra boost of Christmas spirit, but just ways in which production has had to change. Amy, what are you hearing?
Well, I'll talk about the choose and cut side as far as like with COVID, you know, they had to decide on some best practices to make sure it was a safe experience for people to go and get a Christmas tree. Great thing about going to a Christmas tree farm is that there's lots of land. So being socially distant is very easy to do. But, you know, sanitizing all the shared equipment, you know, setting up situations as far as like signage and wearing masks and keeping people, you know, 6 feet apart in lines and things like that. So that's kind of some of the stuff that the choose and cut side was looking at. And I know Scott can talk a little bit about, you know, as far as help and how that has been affected with COVID.
Sure. Scott, I know that there's a lot of seasonal labor that you use to get through the season. How have things changed for those folks?
Well, we've tried to distance and create separation as best we could. One thing we found was having mandated COVID testing, the state mandated testing back in August. So any employee and every new hire had to be tested. And, you know, we fared very well through that. Anybody who may have tested positive, they ended up being quarantined, just as anybody would have in any other setting. So what we found is that we had the ability to kind of manage that. Our work crews tend to live together, travel together, work together. And so through that, we didn't really have to adapt a whole lot in that practice.
Scott, earlier in the pandemic, it was really hard to get access to tests. Are you where you need to be in terms of getting the resources to get people tested?
Yeah, it wasn't a problem. The state provided the testing resources as well as the personnel to conduct the tests. So, you know, that that was in place. Larger agricultural producers and ag manufacturing ended up having to do that as a health order mandate starting back in August. And so it was initially on us to find the tests. The state was able to provide those to us.
That's awesome. I know, Scott, that you keep in touch with a lot of retailers. Are you seeing much different on the lots where trees are sold this year?
Well, presently I'm in Ohio, and we are finding that folks have actually fewer trees on the ground here this week than they would like. They still are optimistic for a strong season, but being able to get more trees or additional product is creating a few challenges for them. There is an undersupply of trees right now in the market, and with this increased demand, it's just putting a little bit further strain on farms being able to try and you know, do they decide to cut into next year's harvest a little bit, which then may have, you know, a domino effect in years to come. So most folks are, nope, this is our number. This is what we need to maintain. Retailers are, you know, they always want more product in, but there's only a level at which we can do when your seed to harvest takes you 10 to 12 years.
Right. Is the shortage strictly due to demand issues right now?
No, it really stems back all the way to 2008. And we had the recession. There was an actual oversupply at the time. And during that oversupply, farms were being paid less. And so they couldn't plant back as much. So it's kind of a combination of a lot of factors all the way back from the recession in 08 to today. So yes, there is increased demand, but it might as well just be an effect from 12 years ago.
Interesting. Amy, can you tell us a little bit more about Michigan's Christmas tree industry? How many farms are there that produce these trees?
Well, there's over 500 Christmas tree farms in Michigan, and it's about a farm value of about $35 million to Michigan's economy.
And do you know how many workers are involved in the industry?
That I would not know. I couldn't even guess. How about you, Scott? Could you guess?
Probably depends on the size of the operation.
Well, I would definitely say there's over 1,000 workers, just considering the size of our farm and what everybody else is doing. You know, at our peak, we had nearly 600 employees on payroll. And, you know, for us, it's a big undertaking to kind of staff up that high. But, you know, year after year, we're able to find workers. And I know a lot of other farms are too, but it is getting harder to, the labor force is harder to come by.
Yeah,
especially this year. You know, I've heard a lot of people talking about how hard it was to get people to work. You know, a lot of students work in farms, you know, through this holiday selling season. And, you know, some people just aren't letting their kids go to work or don't want them to this year because of COVID. So it was a little bit more of a challenge.
Michigan growers, I know, handle several different types of tree species. Scott, can you tell me about a few of your favorite varieties?
Right now, the definite consumer favorite is the Fraser fir. And that is our number one selling tree that we produce. We're finding that the true firs, the Fraser fir, the balsam fir, those tend to be the more popular. But we are seeing even a resurgence, amongst some of the pine and some of the spruce. Maybe that's attributable to, people not being able to find the exact species they want, maybe in their zip code, but we are seeing a resurgence. We're also seeing a bit of resurgence in Michigan State tree, the Eastern White Pine, that used to be a highly popular tree, and people kind of went away from it. But it seems to be that there's a resurgence there.
If you're just joining us, we're talking Michigan Christmas trees with Amy Start, the executive director of Michigan's Christmas Tree Association, and Scott Powell, nursery manager for Dutchman Tree Farms. I wonder what it is that drives the trends with Christmas trees. I feel like I wasn't seeing that many slender trees in decades past, but all of a sudden, maybe about 10 or 15 years ago, they really got to be a thing. Do you know, like, is it just people posting pictures of trees on Pinterest somewhere and somebody decides, hey, this is a good look? Or, you know, some Instagram influencer says, hey, this is a beautiful tree that I got this year. What do you have eyes on in terms of what may be driving people's tastes, Scott?
What we see is the largest demographic of consumer for real trees is the baby boomers. As they age, they don't want that big, huge, monstrous tree. And so there's a bit of a trend to a smaller tree, a lighter tree, a more consumer-friendly product. You know, it's not the Clark Griswold opening up the tree in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation anymore. They want that smaller, slender tree. It's easier for them to handle. We're seeing a very large move to what's called a tabletop tree. It's a 2 to 4 foot tree where, you know what, we still want that real tree in the house, but man, you know, we're going to go and we're grandparents now, and maybe we're not going to have the grandkids over. So we're seeing a move and a push there into that sector. But it's also just like my kids are doing. You know, I've got 5 kids at home. And we have 2 small tabletop trees up in the house, and the kids have them in their bedrooms. So there is a big push there as well.
Amy, what do you keep an eye on in terms of what might be driving people's taste?
Oh, I think there's a lot of things that, you know, people look at when they go to get a Christmas tree. And I know personally, you know, I like a tree that can hold heavier ornaments. My mom loves to get me like holiday Hallmark kind of ornaments, and they're very heavy. So I try to find trees that can have stronger branches that can hold those ornaments. There's people that like, you know, trees with big holes so they can put those big ornaments in. But then, you know, too, I think one of the things I think people don't realize too is when they go out to get a Christmas tree, you know, you go into the field and you look at it, and it can be a Clark Griswold moment, because you can go look for a tree and then you're like, oh, that's the perfect one. You get it home and you're like, wow, that is a very large tree. I didn't realize it was so big, because they don't look as big out in the field. So I do want to warn people that, like, measure your space ahead of time. And then when you go out there, you know, really take a look at the tree that you're purchasing to make sure it fits that space.
Yeah. What should I look for when I'm picking out a Christmas tree? Amy mentioned the size issue and just having a realistic sense of what they're going after. But Scott, do you have any other tips?
You know, everyone always, the essential thing is making sure that that trunk is straight, you know, and making that determination. You know, we grow trees, and, you know, we've got thousands of acres of trees. But at the end of the day, when you're out in the field, it's just finding that one that just kind of catches your eye. And, you know, we always say happy spouse, happy house, and just making sure that everybody's on board with it's always a wise decision as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the biggest trend. It's what you like when you go out there, you know, what tree calls you, you know, like, oh yeah. You know, I mean, sometimes I go out and I'll think, oh, you know, I want a Fraser fir. And then I get out there and I'm like, no, I want that concolor fir. It smells like oranges and it's so pretty. You know, it's just like, yeah, that's the one, you know? And so I think that's the neat thing about real Christmas trees is they're all different and they're all unique.
There is a huge debate going on in my household right now about how to get the tree to absorb more of the water that we provide for it. Could one of you give us the quick lesson on how to care for a real tree once you get it home?
Yeah, I'll take that. Okay. So, you know, whether your tree was cut 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago, or you just cut it yesterday, when you get that home, trees are naturally going to heal themselves. And so they're going to want to close off that fresh cut. And so you want to make sure you give it a fresh cut. And within maybe an hour or two, try to get it in even a 5-gallon bucket of water. Once you get it home, you get in the bucket of water, get it in the stand, and just really, really watch that water line to make sure that water's staying above it. So it is. It's all about a fresh tree. It's all about a fresh cut. And then just making sure you're on top of the water level. There's a lot of people out there that'll try to sell you or tell you on, hey, add sugar water or add this additive to it. At the end of the day, it's just fresh water and a fresh cut. And that's really all the consumer needs to do to make sure their tree's going to last them through the season.
Yeah. And it does take a lot of water, especially that first week. I'm always quite surprised. And before I got into the business myself, you know, we had water our tree. And then, you know, a day or two would go by and my husband would say, I think the stand might be dry. And of course, we'd put our little fingers in there and oh, it's dry as a bone. Not a good idea. So stay on top of the water. Very, very important.
Is there anything you need to do, assuming that you do have that the fresh cut on the bottom? Is there anything special that you need to do to help the tree absorb?
No, a tree's naturally going to move water up and down through the cambium layer of in the bark. And so as that, the tree's just going to run its natural course during that time. There's nothing special that really needs to be done, just making sure that water level stays above the bottom of that cut. And the consumer, the end user is going to be happy, and you'll be able to enjoy that tree throughout the season.
You know, Scott, my last question is just, I'm thinking about what you said about how prior years' economic trends can influence what's going to happen in the years to come. I don't know if this year is normal in any sense of the word, but are the things happening in 2020 going to influence your farm's business in the years to come, do you think?
Well, you know, everything that we do is gearing for a decade ahead. And had we had a crystal ball 10, 12 years ago, you know, we maybe would have made some different business decisions. But today, you know, everything that we do is going to drive us to what we're going to do in the future. As we look at maybe what are consumer trends and what are we hearing in the upcoming generations, you know, that'll help determine how we plant our trees, how we space our trees out in the field, what species we grow. What we do know is we are seeing a very strong movement to common shared experience amongst, you know, households. And so, you know, we're very positive for that. One challenge that every facet of agriculture faces is an aging grower population. And so, you know, trying to encourage farms to get other generations involved is going to be key and critical to the continued success for agriculture in the United States and Christmas tree farms, even right here in Michigan.
Amy, if folks still haven't found that perfect tree, how do you suggest they get started?
Just if they're looking for a Christmas tree or a farm, go to our website, which is mcta.org. And there is a web locator on there that will help them find a farm and a tree right in their area.
Amy Start is Executive Director of the Michigan Christmas Tree Association. We've been talking to Scott Powell, too. He's the nursery manager at Dutchman Tree Farms in Manton. Scott, Amy, it's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for taking some time with us.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Thank you, April. Merry Christmas.
It's official. Michigan's annual grudge match game against Ohio State has been called off for the first time in a century. Michigan's athletic director, Ward Manuel, said in a statement that the Wolverines' count of positive COVID tests just keeps on climbing and it's not safe to play. Might this have anything to do with oddsmakers predicting a 30-point margin of victory for Ohio State? Manuel has had fighting words in this week's athletic department video for anyone suggesting Michigan is trying to dodge the Buckeyes or keep OSU from the six games it needs to qualify for the Big Ten championship game.
I think it's ridiculous. I have to pause because my words, the anger, I was infuriated by the insinuation that Michigan would do anything other than play a football game. We've been playing this game since 1879, and we're winning this program for a reason, because we play whoever's in front of us. And the only way we want to keep anybody from moving on is to beat them on the fields of play. And to insinuate that, to say something other than that, is a statement by a fool.
Take that, Kirk Herbstreit. Have to ask, though, do we buy this? Frequent listeners to Stateside may know that I was born in Fortress Columbus. And while my Love, Honor, and Obey contract includes a U of M rider, I sometimes feel the intense gravitational pull of Ohio State. But you know what? This is a pandemic. Our athletes aren't even being paid for their work and their risk. And I have to say, I've seen some Michigan. I believe Ward Manuel. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia. The executive producer of the show is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.